I'm Veronica Marshall at the Capitol this week on Senate Spotlight. Balancing the budget to avoid a deficit means changes will have to be made. One idea currently on the table, cuts to disability services.
The governor's budget comes down, it's this thick, and this year it's full of cuts on these services. And the people sit home and they're terrified.
Why senators say the governor's current budget proposal needs changes of its own. Plus,
Minnesotans expect their government to prioritize efficient and ethical use of their hard-earned tax dollars. This bill would deliver that.
An update to the push for a new fraud-fighting tool, where the bill to create an Office of the Inspector General is now. And artificial intelligence, it's here, now what?
Properly done, regulation will encourage the kind of innovation that can help drive AI's use in Minnesota.
Government has a tendency to overreact and stifle in many cases.
Senators hear the cases for and against regulating artificial intelligence in Minnesota. That's all coming up.
Senate Spotlight is produced by the Minnesota Senate and Senate Media Services.
Freedom, safety, support, and inclusion. That's what the state aims to provide people living with disabilities and their families and caregivers. But this progress comes at a price, and the state's budget is stressed. Here to talk with me about the needs and challenges this population faces and how the Senate can help this session is Republican Senator Jim Abler. Senator, thank you for being here.
Well, it's great to be here.
All right,
in
Senator.
In these times.
Yeah, yes, thank you for making time for this.
Yeah.
In a recent Human Services Committee meeting, after hearing some discussion about Senate File 401, which discusses home and community-based waiver services, you said, we spend more than any other state for it not to work well. Talk me through that statement. How much are we spending? What are we spending it on? And where might we be going wrong with that?
Well, actually, Minnesota has three constitutional duties: education, transportation, and public safety. But there's also kind of a social contract about how do we care for those who have more challenges, seniors, people with disabilities, and we spend a lot. The general fund is, I don't know the number, but $20 billion or better over the period of time and 2 years, and it's matched by federal money, and it's, together, it's the largest part of the budget. And so that's our commitment. The challenge is spending all that money and well over 100,000 people who need our care, who really don't do well on their own. Some can't get out of bed without help. It's really clunky. And the sad thing is, for all we spend, almost nation-leading in terms of our commitment per person, it doesn't always give people the results they want. And that's the ongoing challenge, and we spend a lot of time talking about that.
Okay. Senator, in that same meeting, there was another bill brought up, Senate File 402, which aims to modify disability waiver rights by making them more competitive. And you, again, said some of the people who need these services are the ones that can't afford them. So talk to me more about this population we're discussing.
Yeah, so I just brought that bill along. If you really have a hard time sleeping, you can read about the disability waiver rate system. And arcane numbers and competitive workforce factors. And anyway, it could be a bestseller, maybe not, just for helping sleep-deprived people. But the thing is, we have a very complicated system about how we pay for the needs of people. We have there's a system of assessments called MIN Choices, which is, frankly, a disaster. We spend $500 million biennium on assessing people. Sometimes people have a problem that's lifelong, and we reassess them every year. They're still having the problem. They have an ongoing disability that is never going to change. We make them sit through hours of evaluation. And then we'll get some services that's approved. It's the same thing as last year, but there's a delay in that. And then this rate setting system is meant to be some kind of rubric to make sure it's all right. And it hardly ever is right. And we've been talking about this for a long time. And so we have to do exceptions and workarounds, and to the point that sometimes more than half the people are on workarounds. Well, if you have a system that's got that many workarounds, let's fix the system. And so we struggle with discussing. So as a legislator, I say, hey, let's go do this. And the department says, okay, we'll go work on it. And next year, hey, let's go fix this. And they say, hey, we're working. And it's really frustrating. At the end, I mean, that's just the government system, and give and take, and there's an administration. But at the end, there's people at the end of that pipeline that want to get to work, that want to go and have every opportunity that's possible. And we agree on it in a bipartisan way. But then you have these long bills that, about how to do stuff. And then when you run short of money, the governor, who's not really part of any of this, it's always the governor's budget. And who is the governor? But anyway, so the governor's budget comes down. It's this thick. And this year it's full of cuts on these services. And the people sit home and they're terrified. The mother of a four-year-old child with Down syndrome, what are we going to do? The widower father of who's now 72 and his son is 45. I don't mind helping him, but when I die, what's going to happen? And there's so much life in this, so much just what's going on in their world, and how do you capture that and look after them in the best way when you have to do it word by word in complicated ways and make an agreement within a budget? So it's really hard, but you could weep every day watching our committee, and you could rejoice every day watching some of the successes.
Senator, you know, just listening to you speak right now, and I listened to your speech at last year's Disability Services Rally, you know, this seems like it's something that you care deeply about and you've taken very personally. Like, talk to me how you got there.
Well, in my day job, I'm a chiropractor, so I saw human needs. But when I got here, I didn't know anything about this. I didn't know what this meant. And I've been here, it's my 26th year of being here, so, you know, call when you get a real job. I just kind of fell into it. I have a compassion for that. And I don't know why. I don't have anybody in my life that I remember this person. Many people in the industry are like, oh yeah, my brother, you know, my son, my mom, and you know, my wife, or whatever. And I don't have that. I just have seen all that. I kind of assimilated it. And I'm able to maybe mirror that back. And so, and some people come, and how can you not want to help when you hear some of the tales of challenge? You know, there's some people with a brain injury or a spinal cord injury can't get out of bed without help. And with some of the things that have gone on, there was one person, I won't tell his name, but his PCA didn't show up on Friday. And I called, well, I'll be fine. He died because he couldn't get out of bed by Sunday. And like, how many of those do you want to listen to? And so that's the disaster part of it. But a mother who has raised her child he's always had some disability since he was born, and she's given her life. And all she wants to do is make it work. And the red tape, and, well, we need to fix this. And she goes like, it's not working. You know, it's just not working. And then they rechange things into different assistant, and it all falls on them. Which, God bless them, but that's not how it's supposed to work. It's supposed to be, with all the money we spend, more than Wisconsin or South Dakota, how can we make it work better? And that's the ongoing challenge, which we've crafted in a very bipartisan manner on the committee. I think it's one of the friendliest, least partisan committees, because we've been able to look at the people. And as we continue to press the agency, which means well also, but it's just really hard.
Yeah, I've seen those committee meetings, and the way you all collaborate is really inspirational and an example of that bipartisan spirit. And you mentioned it's because of the subject matter. You know, because of that, you know, what is the most critical issue that you think the committee can take on this session?
Well, we're going to be broke. I'm sure people have mentioned on your show that we had an $18 billion surplus, and they spent $10 billion more. And now there's a deficit. And in my mind, I wasn't in charge, and I'm not here to disparage anybody, but I think that they were not wise in how they spent a lot of that money and buying things. I've had to sit through a couple deficit times. 2011 was the biggest. We were $5 billion in deficit. So I coined earlier essential, important, and nice. What's essential? A guy who can't get out of bed, a woman who's challenged and she's 70 years old, what happens to my son, a hospital, those kind of things. Essential. And some things are important. I mean, housing's important. And some things are just kind of nice. How about a little program to help people do something? And so we bought a lot of nice programs. in the last 2 years. And there's nothing wrong with them, but they're not a priority. And we didn't take care of their priorities, hospitals, nursing homes, some of these programs here. And now it's coming home to roost. And in the governor's budget, and again, I don't know who the governor is, and they just kind of went through, but they wound up reducing general fund spending by $1.5 billion, which translates to a $3 billion hit, because it's almost all half funded by the feds. We put a dollar and they put in about a dollar. And they also shifted some costs to the counties on the order of $800 million over 4 years. And like, that's not going to work. Never mind the politics. He had to put out a budget, there it is. That's your priorities, but I don't think we should cut nursing homes or in a damaging way, cut the disability funding and make it not work. So the challenge is, how do we find a way to make it work and still balance the budget, given, in my mind, the poor choices that were made that we just burnt through a bunch of money. And so it's really hard. And so what I'm trying to accomplish personally is, if we do something a little different, we know it's gonna save money. Here's the irony. If I could spend $1 million on some way to get people out of bed better and save $3 million in the end, in the budget process, I'm charged $1 million, and I don't get credit for the three. And that winds up in the bottom line in November when they do the budgeting forecast, and that goes to roads and tax cuts and whatever else. And so I'm trying to push the departments and the budget people, can we take credit for that earlier so we can actually find a way to balance the budget without hurting anybody? And pushing reforms and pushing all the good ideas that people have. That's my burden and what I'm trying to accomplish.
Senator, is there anything else you'd like to share about what you want to do this session or any challenges you guys may experience?
Well, I think the people want to stay engaged. And if, you know, there's folks watching here that are worried about what's happening in the disability programs, I urge them to steer away from just partisan attacks one way or the other. It just doesn't work in this arena. But they give us good ideas, help us find a way to serve our 100,000 people better so that they can do what we all intend. And to me, that's the best way. So,
Senator, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
When it comes to the governor's latest budget proposal and its cuts to human services programs, county leaders say they didn't have a seat at the table. So senators gave them a seat and a say.
To offset the state's financial shortfall, the governor's new budget proposal features cuts to the state's human services spending, like disability waiver services.
While the governor proposes $1.5 billion in human services cuts, that figure includes $460 million in cost shifts to our local counties. This is effectively a property tax increase that will be felt by Minnesotans across the state.
County commissioners came to the Capitol to say those cuts and costs would be felt by their residents one way or another.
Shifting costs to counties will directly impact property taxes and will affect the most vulnerable populations who are already struggling to pay basic needs such as housing, grocery, and health care.
Our property tax-paying citizens are all but tapped out. And yet the state is alarmingly casual in its suggestion that counties absorb these costs by simply going back to the property tax well time and time again, no matter how dry it might be.
To solve the problem, senators say we have to work together.
If we're gonna solve these really challenging fiscal pictures that we have, we need to work with our local units of government. We need to work with county officials who are on the ground and understand where there might be savings opportunities and where we need to invest.
Counties are willing to and want to partner with DHS to have conversations about policy changes that can control costs without cost shifts.
We are here to be part of a conversation, to collaborate with our Republican and Democratic leaders alike. We're trying to help the state find sustainable solutions, and it is critical that our state works with us to create policies that support both urban and rural communities in providing the services that our residents need.
Despite the disagreements on where to find savings to balance the budget, Senator Rasmussen says he expects the budget will be completed on time.
Navigating health insurance coverage can be complicated, but it can be especially difficult for families with newborns who have just tested positive for a disability and need immediate care. Now, there's a bipartisan bill to get those newborns the coverage they need faster. Senate File 1175 allows immediate temporary Medicaid coverage for babies with positive newborn screening results while their full Medicaid application is being processed.
By facilitating that prompt access to medical assistance, we can improve survival rates and long-term health outcomes.
The care is going to be there. All this will do is expedite it in a much quicker way so that they get approved for some reimbursement at a much more timely rate.
In Minnesota, between 2017 and 2023, 763 newborns were identified as having a heritable or congenital disorder that required urgent intervention. After passing as amended in the Human Services Committee, the bill now returns to the Health and Human Services Committee.
This is not a Democratic issue. This is not a Republican issue. This is a Minnesota issue. It is a human issue. And if we do not come together to address it now, we will be facing consequences that extend far beyond the walls of our schools.
One-third of Minnesota students report feeling long-term mental health problems, according to the most recent student survey. Symptoms of anxiety and depression have also gone up since 2019. As part of Mental Health in Schools Day, educators came to the Capitol to talk to the Senate Education Policy Committee about what they're seeing in the classroom and what can be done to help students.
In my school district alone, over the last 2 weeks, we have conducted almost 20 suicide risk assessments, and the majority of these assessments were conducted in elementary buildings.
School social workers say students in crisis impact everyone in the classroom. More and more often, classrooms are being evacuated due to violent or other unsafe behavior. The testifiers said school social workers can solve a lot of these issues by addressing their root causes and providing support and resources to students and their families.
When you have people telling kids that they matter, who they are is real and beloved, and that they have inherent worth and dignity because they are here, that matters.
We have caring, lovely people that are in our buildings that are doing that work every day. We just need a few more of them.
More than half of the state's social workers are part-time or have their hours split between different schools, leading to burnout or a lack of candidates for the open positions.
Our school counselors that are licensed here are leaving and going to Wisconsin, Iowa, South Dakota, and North Dakota, where student to school counselor ratios are significantly smaller.
In 2023, Minnesota established the Student Support Personnel Workforce Pipeline Program, which awards grant money to university-level programs to support students pursuing careers as school psychologists, counselors, and social workers. Given the recent student survey results, some on the committee questioned if there was a better solution for addressing students' mental health needs.
We need to really think about this. How are we going to succeed? And maybe we're thinking that the school being the point of this is what we're not succeeding at that.
Unmet mental health needs can also lead to chronic absenteeism, which has nearly doubled in Minnesota over the last decade. Statistics show students who miss at least 10% of the school year in their early years are four times more likely to drop out of high school. The discussion around starting a new government agency to counter fraud, waste, and abuse continues here at the Capitol.
Senate File 856 calls for the creation of an Office of the Inspector General, and it was heard during the State and Local Government Committee.
An Office of Inspector General is more than catching fraud after it happens. It's about building on a culture of accountability and proactive oversight. It's a practical solution to ensure accountability, transparency, and fiscal responsibility in state government.
As an executive agency, the bill gives the Office of the Inspector General, or OIG, more independence as an oversight authority.
It is key that this be independent from all the rest of the functions of government, because those functions of government are going to be under its scrutiny.
The bipartisan bill faced questions from the committee, with members expressing concerns about overlapping responsibilities between the OIG and the state's current fraud-fighting tools, such as the Office of the Legislative Auditor, or OLA.
I think each term has to be really, really clearly defined to make sure we don't cross and gray the responsibilities between those two important entities.
OLA looks at more systems base and patterns and a larger scope, whereas an OIG would look more at specific providers and recipients.
There were also questions around the OIG's ability to prosecute criminal behavior. The bill now heads to the Judiciary Committee for further review. If the bill is approved, the Inspector General would be appointed by January 1st, 2026. As the number of companies utilizing artificial intelligence, or AI, goes up, so will its impact on Minnesota's economy and labor market. But will that impact be positive or negative? Senators on the Labor Committee heard from a variety of experts regarding the implementation and use of AI in Minnesota this week.
We face a future with more expected job openings than available workers. AI can help bridge this gap by augmenting human labor, automating repetitive tasks, and allowing workers to focus on higher value problem solving roles.
What we've seen so far is workers overwhelmingly saying that the use of AI in their work is in fact adding to their workloads and not increasing productivity.
Some of the testifiers called for legislation to proactively manage the implementation and use of AI to protect workers, while others cautioned against over-regulating the industry.
We have a unique opportunity now to shape AI, shape how AI is integrated into our economy. Again, that is not a call to slow down AI innovation, but rather to recognize that the choices we make in the coming years are likely to have profound implications for guiding that innovation and making sure that it enhances economic opportunity rather than exacerbating inequality.
AI is coming. It's something that we're going to want to use and use in a responsible way, and we need to regulate it. I totally agree. And I'm hoping that there's also those opportunities for us to, you know, be aware of the old biases that we have and try to use these tools to actually combat them.
Government needs to tread lightly and make sure that the data is there to justify any restrictions. When you have advances in technology, there is going to be a certain level of displacement, but it usually opens up other opportunities.
So there's a real need for, I think, governments to think about how to ensure that that initial displacement does not drive rapid amounts of inequality that I think we saw on the back end of the Industrial Revolution all the way up to the Computer Revolution.
Any AI policies that prioritize rigid labor protections over business competitiveness could unintentionally harm Minnesota's economic future. While ensuring fairness in the workplace is important, policies that make AI adoption overly expensive or cumbersome for employers could potentially drive companies and jobs out of Minnesota.
During the meeting, senators were told the state's workforce is particularly vulnerable to the impacts of AI, especially workers in Greater Minnesota. Some of the research presented also found that by 2030, workers in lower-wage jobs with less education and women are more likely to be displaced by AI and will need to change their occupations. What do you think? Is AI the answer to Minnesota's workforce challenges? Does it need to be regulated to protect workers? Or does the answer lie somewhere in between? Let us know by joining the conversation on our social media pages. One bipartisan bill to legalize sports betting in Minnesota fails in committee, while another sees some success.
This is the first stop you have, Senator Klein. If you could introduce yourself and proceed with your bill, I'd appreciate it.
This bill, for the first time, enjoys the support of the previous combatants in this area, the 11 sovereign tribal nations, Canterbury Park, the Allied Charities, and the Minnesota professional sports teams. More importantly, this bill continues to have the support of a majority of Minnesotans in polling.
After hearing testimony, the Senate's State and Local Government Committee members voted on Senate File 757.
Having not a sufficient number of votes to pass the committee, the bill stalls out here. So,
with 6 votes in favor of the bill and 6 opposed, it did not pass the committee. Committee members said the bill brought up a lot of questions and wasn't ready to move forward yet. The bill was brought forward by DFL Senator Matt Klein, who responded to the bill's defeat by saying, quote, "The committee missed an opportunity to advance legislation that Minnesotans have been demanding for years. Our constituents, tribes, and charities are more than ready for legal and responsible sports wagering. It's time for lawmakers to catch up and get this done." The committee then heard DFL Senator John Marty's sports betting bill, Senate File 978. Senator Marty says his bill includes stronger consumer protections.
This bill is not something I'm saying, please vote this out of committee.
the committee voted on another one earlier, and I'm saying if at some point you decide you want to move forward on sports betting, I would argue we should do it with strong regulations. And yes, they won't be as profitable as it could be, but it would be strong regulations to address the growth and problems that we are sure to see with this because the other states have done it.
The bill was unanimously passed by the committee and was laid on the table. That means it'll stay in the state and local government committee for now. As you follow our coverage of Senate meetings, hearings, and events online or over the airwaves, have you noticed that things look different this year? A massive undertaking.
Fiber alone, we're probably 10 miles of fiber. The scope of this project is actually really big. We're running an amazing amount of infrastructure, whether it's fiber, video cable, audio cable. I mean, we probably have a crew of 30 people who have been working for 6 months on this. I can't even estimate it in the amount of hours.
And even if he could tally up all of the hours spent upgrading the Senate's streaming and broadcast systems, Bill Poor, Director of Engineering and Operations for Senate Media Services, says the true value of the upgrade can't be measured in numbers alone.
Having this fire up and operate as expected is going to be amazing for not only me, but the public as a whole, just because of the expanded coverage and the expanded access the general public now has to the Senate. Anything that allows us to bring the content of the hearings and the floor sessions out to the public is being touched by this project. So we'll have multiple cameras in every hearing room, just like we've had in the chamber for many years. Now we'll be able to see your individual senators talking, testifiers will be on the screen, which all the time they weren't before.
This gives the citizens more insight to everything that's going on, and you can really find the committees that you're interested in and follow them closely from start to finish throughout the legislative process. There's a lot of important issues that happen during the year, and so now we're able to provide that coverage throughout the year, and whatever you're interested in at home or as a professional working or just living in Minnesota, we're able to provide that service so you can see it. This equipment upgrade not only improves streaming standards, but also broadcast television standards that will continue to make Minnesota a leader in legislative coverage.
Mark Martinez, Senate Media Services Director, says the upgrade supports the Senate's mission of keeping the public informed and engaged, now and in the future.
It provides that transparency into the proceedings so folks at home can view what's happening with their senators in their districts and without any kind of bias whatsoever. That's our role, is just to provide the information as it occurs.
And we don't know what we're going to be doing in the future, so we're building in expansion capability for what might come tomorrow.
This upgrade is just one part of a larger plan. In 2 years, the House of Representatives media team will begin the next phase after the state office building remodel is complete. That's all the time we have today. Thank you for joining us, and see you next time.